Hi. Hallelujah. Today we're going to talk about Babylon and mainly the city of Babylon, and then we're going to say a little bit about the actual empire of Babylon itself. Before we do, I wanted to mention, you might already have these charts, but if you really have trouble understanding the flow of Bible history, and if it's not too clear to you exactly where I'm coming from when I discuss these empires, you might want to consider getting these two charts. I don't think they're that much money. But one of them is the Old Testament patriarchs and judges, and the other is Old Testament kings and prophets. And I'll tell you what's good about these charts. Number one, they show the flow of Bible history. And they give you the dates, and they show you the major events as they unfold. But then right below the major line or timeline for Bible history, they also have contemporary world history at the same time. So that you can look, for example, right down here, and you can see what is happening as far as Bible history is concerned. Then also you can see all the Babylonian kings and when they ruled, and they're ruling during what time, and when they're ruling, what king in Israel is ruling, and what king in Babylon is ruling. And so that's real helpful. That's real handy. So that might help you out, because we don't really have time in here to go through real carefully and to study all these various histories, and that's really outside the scope of this class, so we're not going to do that. Well, let's talk about the kingdom of Babylon here briefly. The thought that I'd like to convey to you, first of all, is that the Babylonian Empire lasted only 70 years. That's not too long compared to some of the other ancient kingdoms. And those 70 years of Babylon coincide exactly with the 70 years in which Judah, the southern kingdom, was in captivity in Babylon. In other words, Babylon began as a nation and as a world empire like around 605 BC, and then they were conquered in 536 BC, which is when Judah came back to the land again. So their 70 years of existence is exactly the same time that Judah was in captivity. And it was the year that Cyrus, king of Persia, conquered Babylon. That was the same year that the Jews were authorized to return to Palestine and come back into the land again. Well, let's talk about the city of Babylon. The city of Babylon. What was it like during that time? Let's say that you were a Jew living in Judah, and all of a sudden you got word that Nebuchadnezzar was coming down, and then you got word that the city fell, and then you got your papers from Nebuchadnezzar to Babylon. And so now you're headed back to Babylon. And you might be one of those that was chosen to actually live in the city of Babylon, maybe be a servant and work for the Babylonians. What would it be like during that time? Well, this is where Daniel ministered, in this very city that we're going to describe for you. It was the wonder of the ancient world. It was an incredible city. It was the capital of the Babylonian Empire. So the city of Babylon was the capital of Babylonia. It had a population of 500,000. That's 500,000 people lived in this city. Now, really, it's an ancient city. It had been rebuilt several times. In fact, it goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 10 and verse 10. The Tower of Babel was built here. Genesis chapter 10 and verse 10. There it began as Nimrod's kingdom. And then later on in chapter 11 of Genesis, chapter 11, 1 through 9, the Tower of Babel was built there. And actually, archaeologists have discovered this very Tower of Babel. According to many, many authorities, they believe they've found the very thing, what is left of it. And then later after that time, after the Tower of Babel began to decay and began to subside and so forth, the city was rebuilt again, and then later on it became a favorite residence of many kings, including the Babylonian kings, and then later on the Assyrian kings and the Persian kings, and even Alexander the Great, during one time, wanted to make this a great and a grand city. But it was really brought to the zenith of its power and glory in the days of Daniel by Nebuchadnezzar. When Daniel came down and when Daniel entered into what probably was the Ishtar Gate, which was the processional gate, it was the major primary gate to get into Babylon, although they had several on every side, but it was the gate that all the troops marched through. When Daniel was brought into the city, it was at its height of power and glory. And Nebuchadnezzar was the king during this time, and he actually reigned, as we mentioned in our lesson yesterday, for 44 years. And for 44 years, he never wearied of building and working on the city of Babylon. He beautified it. He built palaces and temples in it. And in fact, it was called both the Eternal City and the Golden City. The Bible calls it that. The Eternal City and the Golden City. It seemed like it was impregnable. It seemed like it could never fall. It seemed like everywhere you look, it was beautifully painted, and it was golden in color. In fact, they had a way of working with tiles that were painted beautifully, and they were like very bright colors. They were reds and orange and yellow and so forth, and they were glazed tiles, so many of their temples and many of their buildings were very bright in color. So it wasn't like a little drab mud hut village. That's not what they went to. It was an incredible village, as we're going to see. Well, how do we really know that Babylon was so great? Well, the splendors of Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon are fairly well known, and the reason why, it starts back in 1899 to 1914. Because during that time, there was a group of Germans that began to uncover the remains of the vast building projects that Nebuchadnezzar had actually built during his time. And during this period of time, when the Germans were excavating this area, they actually found many of Nebuchadnezzar's own inscriptions. They found many of his own tablets that talked about his building processes and so forth. And then modern excavations, in fact, they're actually trying to rebuild and restore the city right now over in Iraq. But modern excavations have actually further attested the almost unbelievable accounts about this ancient city. Let me describe it for you. Let's actually look at it. Ancient historians that actually saw the city, and Herodotus and others were actually there and actually walked down its streets and therefore recorded it as far as actually what it looked like, said that it was a square. It was a square city, 14 miles to a side. So it was like a cube or a square, and if you, actually a square would be better than a cube, but if you walk down one side of the wall, it would be 14 miles long. If you walk down the other side, it would be 14 miles. Every side was 14 miles. So that the city itself covered an area of nearly 200 miles, about 200 square miles now. And the city was laid out for convenience and defense. Those were the two primary goals that were their objectives, convenience and defense. And there were two walls that surrounded this city. They had an outer wall, and then they had three quarters of an area of agricultural land, and then there was a second wall. So there were like two massive walls that went around the whole city, and in between those two walls was this area to plant crops and so forth. And there was no housing permitted between these two walls. They used it extensively for agriculture and for gardens and for orchards and for fields and for cattle raising, and that's all it was used for. And with the crops that they grew in between those two walls, they could actually sustain the whole city. And they could sustain it indefinitely because they never had to leave the city. The crops were right there between the two walls, and they could grow all the crops they wanted, and they could support themselves, see, with their own food. And that's, in fact, why it is called the Eternal City, because it could withstand a siege indefinitely. You see, the ancient method of conquering cities was to surround the city and to starve them out. And the Romans often did that. They did that with Jerusalem. They took 2 years to conquer the city of Jerusalem. They simply surrounded the city, and they said, anyone that comes out, off with your head. And so the people would remain in the city for like a year or 6 months or whatever, and then they'd start running out of food, and then they'd start eating the corpses of those that had died before them. And that was fairly common. And the Bible talks about the Jews doing that very thing. Well, let's go on. Let's look at this city further. We find that the outer wall had a moat surrounding it. You know what a moat is? A moat is a body of water that surrounded it. And it was 75 feet wide. And actually, it was the Euphrates River. This city was built so that it straddled the Euphrates River. And so it was like a square city built like this. This is not going to be real to scale now, understand? There were two walls like this. And then the river Euphrates flowed right down through the middle of the very city like this. And then furthermore, they channeled it so that there was a moat that flowed all the way around the city as well. And this moat was like 75 feet wide, and it was flowing water.
Well, it's very hard to get your troops across something like that. So anyone that would want to conquer them, good luck. Because of that flowing moat of water. So it looked just like that. So the main city with a river flowing right through it, with a river flowing right around it. That's how they had it built, with those two walls. Let me tell you a little bit about the walls. The outer wall was 300 feet high. 300 feet high. That's tall. When you stop and think about a telephone pole now, what's that? About maybe 40 feet or something? A telephone pole? This is 300 feet tall. That is tall. That's like half the Space Needle or whatever of the wall. And it was 75 feet wide. That's a massive wall. And furthermore, they built it so that the walls went 37 feet down into the ground, 37 feet down, so that there was no way you could ever tunnel underneath those walls. That was a common ploy, to tunnel underneath the wall. Well, when it's 37 feet down into the ground, good luck. And then this thing was built out of solid brick. They were able to build bricks, and they were able to fire them up, and it didn't rain very much out in that country, so they didn't have to worry about the rain wearing away the bricks. And they were built of brick, and those bricks were 1 foot square, and they were like 3 to 4 inches thick. In fact, they found a number of those bricks. You can go to almost any museum that's a major museum, and they'll have some bricks from Babylon there. And many of them actually have Nebuchadnezzar's own stamp on them, and you can actually see his name. It would be in Babylonian, of course. But they say, Nebuchadnezzar, King of Babylon, and they're stamped right on those bricks, and they would stamp them. And some of them have a number of his boasts on them. One of them recalls his boast in Daniel 4:30, and it's stamped with the statement, "The fortification of Esagila, Marduk's temple, and Babylon, I, Nebuchadnezzar, strengthen and establish the name of my reign forever," end quote. See, so they've got the actual brick, and now the Bible's talking about him as well and calling him by name, and they have since uncovered that. And then on top of this 300-foot high wall, they had 250 towers built on top of that, all the way around the perimeter. And there were guard rooms for soldiers in those towers. And so with 250 towers that are built on top of a 300-foot tall wall, that gives you the definite advantage against the enemy. In fact, when the archers would come against them, or if they wanted to come against them, there's no way that they could really even shoot up against them, because the people up in the towers could shoot down with tremendous advantage. And furthermore, there was too much water to poison, because the river Euphrates flowed all the time. They couldn't poison the water system. And with their food supply, they were just thoroughly defended. There was no way that you could take over that city. And then the city was entered by 25 gates on each side. They had like 25 gates on this side, 25 gates on that side, all the way around, 25 gates on each side. And each one of those gates was made of solid brass. Solid brass. Have you ever tried to burn brass? That was, again, another ancient tactic to get into the city, was to like shoot flaming arrows and hot pitch and so forth against the gates, and to burn the gates and catch them on fire, and then, you know, charge through the gates. Well, these were made of solid brass. There's no way that you're ever going to break through something like that. And each one of those gates was also guarded by towers as well. So they had towers on top of them. And then when you came through the gate, the gates opened up to flat, straight, level, paved streets. So like there were 25 streets that went across this way and 25 this way. So it was perfectly divided out. And what you really end up with is that all the streets ran at right angles to the wall, and it divided the city into 625 squares. So it was all laid out just very beautifully, very neatly done. And then, as we mentioned, the city was divided by the river Euphrates. The river Euphrates flowed right down through the midst of it, and in almost equal parts, although I've seen some maps that do vary a little bit, but it pretty much divided the city into equal parts. And then what they did, because they actually had gates that ships could sail right into the city and dock at their docks, and because of that, they had walls on the shores of the river as well, so that no enemy could come in and then enter the city from the inside of the river. So they had walls on the inside of the river as well. And also they had 25 gates that connected the streets on these walls. See? So on each one of these gates, it opened up to the 25 streets. And same on this side as well. So when you did come in, there were great walls on the inside of that river Euphrates.
And then they had one major bridge that crossed from one side of the city to the other side of the city. And primarily what the gates were used for here is either for ferry boats to go across it or for like unloading cargo or something from the ships. But they had one major bridge that crossed the River Euphrates there that they've since discovered. And it was on stone piers, and it's a half-mile-long bridge. Half-mile-long bridge made of stone, 30 feet wide, and they had a drawbridge on this thing. And they could remove that drawbridge at night, see? So there's no way that the enemy could come in the river and get on that bridge and then enter the city because they had a drawbridge on it, see? And then they also had a tunnel that went underneath the river as well. They dug a tunnel underneath the river, and the tunnel under the river was 15 feet wide, and 12 feet high, that they dug all the way underneath the channel of the river. So that conceivably, if one half of the city did fall, and the enemy did get into one half of the city, they could go underneath the tunnel, and they could close up the tunnel, take the drawbridge down, and they had this whole other half of the city, see? And they could keep on battling against the enemy.
All right.
And then they had an inner wall. So they had one outer wall, 300 feet tall, and then they had an inner wall, and the inner wall was 375 feet tall. So if you did somehow make it, you know, across the moat and make it across the outer wall and somehow get through or tunnel under or whatever you do, I don't know what you do, but if you could get over that and cross the 3/4 mile agricultural space, you came to the second wall, and the second wall was 375 feet tall and 87 feet thick. 87 feet thick. And on that were towers 70 to 90 feet tall. Now that's up there. That is up there. When you've got a wall that's 370 feet tall and then another tower on top of that that's 90 feet tall, that makes your wall a total height of about 450 feet tall. And there were a total of 250 towers on this inner wall. And in fact, the one ancient historian claimed that four horse chariots could race down this inner wall side by side, and it was that wide. Not that they necessarily did it, but it was that wide. And, of course, the walls were solid. There's no way that battering rams were effective against it. So it was a very, very impregnable city as far as actually falling. That's what Daniel was able to walk down in, and that's what Daniel was able to see. I'm sure that they became a little bit discouraged when they said, Israel, Judah, we're going back to Judah in 70 years. Someone's going to conquer this city. We might as well put our roots down. We're going to be here for a while, you know. Let me tell you a couple things that were either inside the city or immediately adjoined to the city. One of them was the Great Temple of Marduk. The Great Temple of Marduk. I'm going to say a couple things about Marduk a little bit later on. Suffice it to say that Marduk was their chief god, M-A-R-D-U-K, Marduk. And they had a temple here. And also, you'll read about him in the Bible. The Bible calls him Baal, B-E-L. Sometimes Baal Nebel, and there's different derivatives of this. But Baal is another title. There was a magnificent pyramid. In fact, the pyramids in ancient Babylonia and so forth are very, very similar to the pyramids in ancient Egypt. Very similar. But there was a pyramid of 8 squares, 8 levels. And every succeeding level was smaller than the preceding one. So that the it had a base on it, and then as you went up, every single level got a little bit smaller on it. Well, there was this pyramid, and inside this pyramid there was a beautiful temple, or actually the pyramid itself was the temple, really, is what I'm trying to say. But inside this pyramid there was a golden image of Baal, and there was a golden table which weighed about 50,000 pounds. 50,000 pounds. A golden image to Baal and a golden table. And then there was a small temple on top of this pyramid. So if you went on top of it, there was a temple built on top. And there it had golden images of Baal and like Ishtar were up there. There were 2 golden lions that they had in that temple on top. There was a golden table 40 feet long and 15 feet wide. I mean, that's a long golden table. I'm not sure if it was wood overlaid with gold or what. It's inconceivable to my mind that it could be solid gold, but the authorities say a golden table 40 feet long and 15 feet wide, and then they had a human figure of solid gold 18 feet tall. 18 feet tall, a figure of solid gold. And you see, the Bible calls it a city of gold in Isaiah chapter 14 and verse 4. Babylon is called a city of gold, Isaiah 14, verse 4. And then also in Daniel chapter 3 and verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar made an image, and it talks about that image, and he commanded everyone to bow down to it, and of course Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to bow down to it. The Bible calls it an image of gold that he built there and commanded everyone to worship it. So that was one thing, the great temple of Marduk. It's also called Atimananki by some authorities. Then there's another interesting thing there. It was Nebuchadnezzar's palace. His palace was also actually adjoined to the city itself, really, is how that was built. But one authority called it one of the most magnificent buildings ever erected on the earth. And the only thing I'm going to say about it is that it was surrounded by three walls, his palace was. The outer wall was 7 miles around, and that surrounded his palace. And then it had a middle circular wall, 4.5 miles around, the inner circular wall. That thing was 300 feet high with towers that surrounded his palace, that middle circular wall. And then finally there was an inner wall, that would be the third wall, 2.5 miles around it, and that was 350 foot tall with towers, 350 feet tall. With towers. So three walls around his palace, and inside of that was his actual palace. And later on we'll read the scripture where it talks about Nebuchadnezzar is walking along in his palace, and what is he saying? Is not this great Babylon that I have built, and so forth? And then there were the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Maybe you've heard of those. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon, they were actually one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. They were built by Nebuchadnezzar, and actually they were built for his wife, and his wife was actually not a Babylonian, she was a Mede. She was from the land of Media. In fact, she was the daughter of Cyaxares the Mede. It was Cyaxares the Mede that had helped Nabopolassar, Nebuchadnezzar's father, conquer Assyria and Nineveh. And so in the process, Nebuchadnezzar ended up with Cyaxares' daughter. She was from Media. And there were a lot more trees in Media. It was a lot prettier in Media where she came from. And she was homesick. She was, as it were, lonesome for the countryside. And so Nebuchadnezzar said, no problem, I'll build you a mountain, and I'll put trees on it and everything. And that's just what he did. He actually built a mountain. And he built this mountain, and he terraced it so that there were different levels on it. On every single one of those levels, there was a luxuriant tropical garden, just a beautiful garden. And there were flights of stone stairs that ran from terrace to terrace. And you could actually, it must have been very tall, because people said you could see it for miles away. And if the walls of Babylon were, you know, as tall as they were, and if the countryside is flat, well, then it must have been very tall to be able to see it from a distance. It was intricately landscaped. There were grasses and vegetation and flowers and shrubs and trees, plants of every variety. And, of course, he had to water them. It doesn't rain that much here. And there's not this type of plants that even grow there, really. They were imported, many of them. And so they were watered from a reservoir up at the top. And he had hydraulic pumps. And they would pump the water up to this reservoir, and then the water would trickle down in various waterfalls and so forth down the sides of this mountain. And then inside the terraces, there were luxurious apartments. And you could go inside these apartments, and it was considered the pleasure ground of the palace, see? And so it was just an incredible, incredible feat that he was able to do, able to build. Very, very impressive to the natural eye. Well, let me read to you a scripture here, Daniel chapter 4, and verse 28, turning to the book of Daniel here. Let's listen to the words of Nebuchadnezzar himself. How would you feel if you built something like that? You know, here's us, most of us, we build something like a birdhouse. And we build that and we say, boy, you know, we show it to our wife. Isn't that neat? Look at this birdhouse I built. Listen to Nebuchadnezzar. Do you think he had a problem with pride? I think he did. It says in Daniel chapter 4 and verse 28, and this came upon the king, Nebuchadnezzar. And in other words, Daniel had just prophesied, Nebuchadnezzar, you're going to be out eating the grass of the field just like a cow is going to eat, which is really not the thing you normally want to say to a king that has that type of power, but God's prophets are bold. And then it says in verse 29, at the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. The king spake and said, is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty, strutting around like a peacock with all of his feathers unfurled. And there he is. And God heard that. God heard that. It says in verse 31, While the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee. And they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and seven times shall pass over thee. That means probably 7 years. And thou shalt know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. The same hour was the thing fulfilled upon Nebuchadnezzar, and he was driven from men, and did eat grass as oxen. And his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until his hairs were drawn like eagle's feathers, and his nails like bird's claws. And at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven. After 7 years of wandering around now, they probably had a fenced-in area or something, and there's old Nebuchadnezzar out there grazing on grass now, chewing his cud. And then it says, at the end of that time, mine understanding returned unto me. He was insane for 7 years. And I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom from generation to generation. It's amazing how a trial can change your perspectives on life, isn't it? And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. And he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say unto him, What doest thou? And at the same time my reason returned unto me. God humbled him. For the glory of my kingdom and mine honor and brightness returned unto me, and my counselors and my lords sought me, and I was established in my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added unto me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he's able to debase or abase. And so God humbled him. And you know, the Bible says that the nations are as a drop in a bucket compared to God. And so here was this man, but all the nations before God are as nothing. The Bible says in Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 18, pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. And incidentally, psychologists do have a name for this sickness. They call it lycanthropy. And that's where the patient fancies himself that he is an animal. And, you know, he's convinced I'm an animal, and he acts like an animal. A lot of people act like an animal, but they don't think that they're really acting like that. But this person feels like, I'm a cow, or I'm a sheep. And they talk to him, and they're convinced, I'm a cow. And in fact, I read the account here when I studied the book of Daniel. They actually had one fellow over in England for a number of years in one insane asylum, and he wanted to eat grass. And he felt like he was a cow, and they let him go out, and they let him graze every single day. And he refused to eat any other food, and he'd go out there on all fours, and he ate grass. And they noticed that they didn't see any real substantial change as far as deteriorating health, so they figured, you know, grass, it's supplying the necessary food for him, so if that's what he wants, I mean, that's what we'll let him eat. And for years, he lived like that. Let me tell you a little bit about Babylonian religion, just a little bit. Babylonian religion, it's quite a bit different than what Israel worshipped, although at times they even fell into this type of thing. A lot of this information that I'm mentioning you can find in the library in the books on archaeology. One good source is Wycliffe's Historical Geography, though, because I know it's real hard to try to write down these facts and figures when I just give them out very rapidly. But archaeologists have found many clay tablets, and these clay tablets actually describe the worship of the various Babylonian gods. And the ruins of the Babylonian cities contain inscriptions of prayers for every conceivable occasion. In fact, they actually had many altars, just like the Greeks did, addressed to the unknown God, and they would often pray to this unknown God, and they would say, May the God who is unknown be favorable to me. Was Yahweh that they were really praying to, and they didn't know him, the God of Israel, and they were worshiping all these other gods. But as far as the manner of their worship, they basically tried to appease their gods by offering sacrifices onto them. And often it would be food or something like drink or something like oil. They did practice magic, and divination and sorcery and exorcism. They did believe in casting out demons, and in fact they lived in constant fear of evil powers. They lived in constant fear of spirits and in fact even demons. And they actually talk about this in their writings, but you see, they don't really have the power to conquer them. They live in fear of them, but actually they're worshiping them, see? It's darkness that has come upon them. Let me tell you what archaeologists have found in this ancient city of Babylon as far as different areas they worshiped in. First of all, they found 53 temples to the great gods, 53 different temples. They found 55 shrines dedicated to Marduk. They've found 300 shrines belonging to earth deities, deities that were in charge of various portions of the earth. They found 600 shrines for celestial deities, like certain planets and stars and that type of thing. 180 altars to the goddess Ishtar, another 180 altars to the gods Nergal and Adad, and 12 other altars to various deities, and then many homes had their own private chapels as well. See? And so they were very religious. They worshipped a lot of these different things. And also, as far as the names of the main gods, don't worry about any of them except for one of them, and I'm going to talk about him real briefly, Marduk here. They did classify their main gods. Here's many of their names now. One god was Anu, the god of the heaven, and also the father of all the gods. And then Inanna, the spouse of Anu, and the goddess of fertility. Inlil, the god of the air and the earth. Ea, the lord of the deep waters, sea, and creator of man, and the god of wisdom. Shamash, the god of power, justice, and war. Ishtar, the supreme goddess of love, symbolized by the planet Venus. And then they had a goddess named Sin, S-I-N. And that was the moon god, and they worshipped her as well. But there was one god that came out on top of this whole pack, and that was Marduk, M-A-R-D-U-K. And that god I would like to have you remember. Not worship, but remember now. The god Marduk. And his temple was here in the city of Babylon. It was called Atimanamki. It was one of the wonders of the ancient world. It was a very incredible temple. I won't describe it for you, but it was a very, very beautiful thing, very elaborate, just like everything else seemed to be in this ancient city. But the Bible does talk about this god Marduk. In Jeremiah chapter 50 and verse 2, he is referred to by two different titles in Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 2. He's called Merodach, which is really just a derivative of Marduk, basically the same title. And then he's called Bel, and the word Bel means Lord. So really it's calling him Lord Marduk. See, that's what it's really saying. He was worshipped by Nebuchadnezzar, and also worshipped by the Assyrians, and even Cyrus the Great, who is a Persian, later came and conquered the city of Babylon, and even Cyrus worshipped him, called him the righteous prince. You might want to read about him in Jeremiah chapter 51 and verse 5, or Jeremiah 51 verse 44, excuse me, Jeremiah 51 44 and Isaiah chapter 46 and verse 1. Isaiah 46 verse 1. Well, there was a real festival that they had in ancient Babylon. It was celebrated once a year. Let me tell you about it. It was celebrated every single spring at the beginning of the new year, and it was called the Anuma Elish. The Anuma Elish. And basically what it is it was a pageant that they had, and it was a celebration. Excuse me, I spelled that wrong. Anuma Elish. Oh, no, I didn't. I did spell it right. Anuma Elish. And that's spelled E-N-U-M-A, and then a second word, Elish, E-L-I-S-H. And what the Anuma Elish was, it was the Babylonian creation account. The Babylonian creation account. They celebrated it once every year. They'd go through the whole thing, and they had various actors in it, and they had a great pageantry was involved in it. A lot of different things were worked into this, but it was basically the Babylonian creation account. And really what it is, it's an epic. And it describes Marduk, and Marduk is the victor over all the chaotic powers of the deep in the battle for creation. And they've actually uncovered the tablets, and the tablets talk all about this very thing. And I want to read some thoughts about this. You want to know how the creation came about according to the Babylonian scheme of things? Let me tell you about it. This is found in Archaeology in the Old Testament by Unger, pages 28 and 29. Archaeology in the Old Testament, Unger, 28, page 29. It's called the Babylonian account of creation, and really what Unger is doing now, he's quoting and reading from some of their own tablets, and then he's expounding on them. So it's going to sound confusing at first, but I'll explain it to you. Really, it's quite elaborate. Here's where we have come from, according to the Babylonians. He says, quote, Tablet 1 in the opening scene presents the primitive age when only living, uncreated world matter existed, personified by two mythical beings, Apsu, male, representing the primeval freshwater ocean, and Tiamat, female, the primeval saltwater ocean. So you've got two bodies of water, and that's they were always there. Matter was always there, and where that came from, they don't even question that. So they don't see God as the ultimate source of creation now. And there were these two bodies of water, Apsu and Tiamat, and they become gods. And it goes on to say that they became the parents of the gods. So from these two oceans then came all the other gods. And then he quotes from a tablet, and it says this. Here's how it reads. When above the heavens had not yet been named, and below the earth had not yet existed as such, when only Apsu, primeval, their begetter, existed, and mother, Mamu, Tiamat, who gave birth to them all, when their waters yet intermingled, and no dry land had been formed, and not even a marsh could be seen, when none of the gods had been brought forth, then were the gods created in the midst of them, Apsu and Tiamat. Lamu and Lahamu, deities, they, Apsu and Tiamat, begat. So here's how it starts off then. You've got two bodies of water. Those two bodies of water become gods. And from these two gods that mate then, Apsu and Tiamat, all the other gods come. And all these other local gods like Ishtar and Sin and so forth come from these two original gods. Well, then it goes on, and now he's elaborating on the tablets and he's commenting. And he says, the brood of gods which Apsu and Tiamat begat became so annoying in their conduct that their father Apsu made up his mind to do away with them. He had this whole brood of gods, and they were his children. And they were extremely aggravating to him. I don't know if they were roughhousing all the time or what, but he got upset with them and he wanted to do away with them. So it says, in this decision, however, to do away with them, he was frustrated by the great god Ea, who fathoms everything, and who discovered the plan and was thereby able to fetter and slay Apsu. So Ea is actually one of the sons of Ea is one of the sons of Apsu, and of course Apsu then would be the father. And Ea gets wind, oh no, Dad's going to kill us. So what Ea does then is to actually capture Apsu and to kill him, see. Well, that really upsets the apple cart, because then it goes on to talk about this, and it says, then Ea begat Marduk, the city god of Babylon, and the real hero of the myth. Meanwhile, Tiamat, at the instigation of the gods, prepares to avenge the death of her husband, Apsu. Because, you see, Apsu's been murdered now, and that death has got to be avenged. She creates gruesome monsters and appoints Kingu, one of her own offspring, as commander-in-chief of her armies. And then it goes on and says, Tablets 2 and 3 recount how Marduk was chosen by his father Ea as champion to fight against the raging Tiamat, and how the gods assembled at a banquet now for a council of war to accouter and commission him for battle. In Tablet 4, Marduk is elevated to supremacy among the gods, the power to destroy and create being made the basis of his exaltation. He destroys and creates a garment. He is declared king and goes to battle against Tiamat with bow, arrow, and club. And the formal defeat of chaos and the victory of order are described graphically in the mighty contest. Let me kind of summarize it for you. Here's what's happening. You've got two gods, Apsu, male, and then Tiamat, female. And from them come all the gods, and they produce all the gods. And there are many of them. And one of these gods is Ea. And Ea catches wind of the fact that Apsu is going to kill all of them. So Ea, in turn, kills Apsu. Well, Tiamat, the wife of Apsu, is upset with Ea. And meanwhile, Ea begets Marduk. And Marduk is going to be the champion of this whole thing. So Marduk is going to fight in behalf of Ea now against Tiamat. And the battle is heating up here. And realize now, things have not yet been created yet. Only the gods are created. The earth as we know it has not really been created yet. Then he goes on and quotes another tablet here. Tiamat and Marduk, the wisest of the gods, took their stands opposite each other. Here's what this tablet is saying. They pressed on to the battle. They drew near in combat. The Lord Marduk spread out his net and enmeshed her, trapped her in this net. The evil wind following after, he let loose in her face. When Tiamat opened her mouth to devour him, he drove in the evil wind so that she could not close her lips. So she opens up her mouth, and he commands this wind, and it fills her whole belly. And it talks about the raging winds filled her belly. And it says her belly was distended, and she opened wide her mouth, and he shot off an arrow, and it tore her belly. It cut through her vitals, it pierced her heart. And when he had subdued her, he destroyed her life. He cast her down her carcass and stood upon it. So here's Tiamat now slain with an arrow right in her vitals. She's dead now, and Marduk is standing on top of her. And, of course, Tiamat would be really her grandmother, his grandmother. And then it says, the helpers of Tiamat attempt to flee, but are captured and cast into prison, the other gods. Meanwhile, Marduk returns to Tiamat to create the cosmos out of her corpse. The Lord rested to look at her dead body to see how he might divide the body and create wondrous things therewith. He split her open like a mussel, like a clam, into two parts. Half of her he set in place and formed the sky, and he fixed the bar and posted guards, and with the other half he made the earth. And that's where we came from. So he took this god Tiamat. You don't look convinced at all. This brother here, he's totally unconvinced. I don't blame you. I'm not convinced at all either. But Tiamat is cut in half, and half of Tiamat forms the waters now and the heavens, and the other half forms the earth. And that's where we've come from. And they celebrated that once every year. Well, I would say that they're really groping for the answer as to where man's come from, you know, reading an account like that. But that was their, you know, you have to admit, it is quite intriguing. It is quite, you know, elaborate. Definitely something that Hollywood would want to get its hands on. Make an excellent movie as far as Hollywood is concerned. Well, the next point, and real brief on this one, we don't have much more to say about Babylon here, but the next point, let me tell you about the captivity of Judah. The captivity of Judah by Babylon. Really, you can read about it in 2 Kings chapter 25. 2 Kings chapter 25. It actually occurred in three installments, three different periods of time. So the Babylonians came down and they conquered Judah, and it began in 605 BC. That's the first installment. That's the first time they came down. In 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar conquered a king called Jehoiakim. Don't worry about the spelling now. And he took the royal seed and the temple treasures to Babylon. And that's found in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, 6 through 7. If you just look in these passages, it will tell you just what I got done telling you. 2 Chronicles 36, 6 through 7, and Daniel chapter 1, 1 through 3. Daniel chapter 1, 1 through 3. So you see, right now, the city of Jerusalem is not yet destroyed, and it's still intact. Then in 597, a second carrying away occurred. In 597, Nebuchadnezzar came again and took the rest of the treasures. And he also took King Jehoiakim this time. And he took 10,000 of the princes and the officers and the chief men, and he took them back to Babylon. Well, you can read about this in 2 Kings chapter 24, 14 through 16. 2 Kings chapter 24, 14 through 16. That's the second installment, 597. Then the third one occurred in 586 BC. And in 586, the Babylonians came again one final time now. And they came and they burned down Jerusalem, they broke down its walls, they destroyed the temple, they put out the eyes of the last king of Judah, King Zedekiah, they poked his eyes out and they carried him in chains back to Babylon along with 832 other captives. And by now they left only the poorest class of people in the land of Palestine, only a very, very poor farming type people were left behind. Everyone else now was either killed or carried back captive. And that is found in 2 Kings chapter 25, 8 through 12. 2 Kings 25, 8 through 12. And Jeremiah chapter 52, 28 through 30. Jeremiah 52, 28 through 30. So Nebuchadnezzar really took 20 years to capture Jerusalem. Now, if you're wondering why, there's two reasons why. One reason why that he took so long is because the Jews would periodically repent and turn to God. And when they would do that, God would grant them a little reprieve, see? But then the second reason why is that he wanted to milk as much tribute money out of them as possible. And so he'd come down and he would, as it were, show his teeth to them and say, I'm going to conquer you unless you give me so much money. And eventually they gave him all the treasuries, all the treasures in the temple and everything else to ward him off. And so he took 20 years to try to get as much money, really, is what he was doing from them. Now, the captivity of Judah by Babylon had been actually predicted 100 years before it came to pass by two prophets, Isaiah and Micah. Isaiah foretold of it in Isaiah chapter 39 and verse 6, Isaiah 39, 6, and Micah did in Micah chapter 4 and verse 10. Micah 4:10. And then Jeremiah gave the very amount of time that would be involved here. Jeremiah said it's going to last only 70 years. 70 years. And that's Jeremiah chapter 25, 11 through 12. Jeremiah 25, 11 through 12. Well, let's talk about the fall of Babylon now. Let's turn to Daniel chapter 5 here. Let's look at a couple interesting thoughts here with the fall of Babylon. You can imagine how that many of the exiles probably gave in to despair. Probably didn't really believe Jeremiah. Probably thought old Jeremiah was, you know, a little bit inaccurate when he said Babylon's going to fall in 70 years. Particularly at the end of the 70 years when Babylon seemed just as strong as it always was. There was really no sign of the fall of Babylon in sight. But you see, God said it was going to fall through Jeremiah, and God's word is flawless. And so Babylon reached its zenith under Nebuchadnezzar, but just 23 short years later, Babylon fell to King Cyrus of Persia. And the account is given at least partially to us here in Daniel chapter 5. But, you know, when you read this account, and when you study ancient Babylon, and this is really talking about the city of Babylon here, the account in the Bible seems kind of far-fetched. It really does. I'll show you why here. Let's read it. Let's read Daniel chapter 5, verses 1 through 6. Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. There he is in his palace there in Babylon. Belshazzar, whilst he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels, which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines might drink therein. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God. Well, that's really sacrilegious to do that. Which was at Jerusalem. And the king and the princes and his wives and his concubines drank in them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver and of brass and of iron, of wood and of stone. They're living it up. They're living in carnal security here. They feel like, oh, no one will ever defeat us. We are safe. We are secure. We are immutable. We are the eternal city. We are the golden city. And then in verse 5, in the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Probably thought he had a few too many as far as when he saw this. Then it says in verse 6, then the king's countenance was changed. It soon became apparent this thing was not just a drunken hallucination, it was real. And his thoughts troubled him. Wouldn't it trouble you if all of a sudden a hand appeared and just started writing something on the wall? Even though he couldn't read it, he was afraid. It says that the joints of his loins were loose. That means his knees were knocking. And his knees smote one against another. Okay, well, let's read down here in verse 13. And at this point in time, he doesn't know what it says, and he wants to figure it out. It says in verse 13, then was Daniel brought in before the king, and the king spake and said unto Daniel, art thou that Daniel which art of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king of my father brought out of Jewry? I have even heard of thee, that the spirit of the gods is in thee, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. You see, all of his astrologers could not interpret this handwriting. All of his sorcerers could not do it. He's calling for Daniel. He's calling for a man of God. And Daniel is going to interpret it. Verse 17, then Daniel answered and said before the king, let thy gifts be to thyself. Give thy rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king and make known to him the interpretation. Here it is, verse 25. And this is the writing that was written. Meeni, meeni, tekel, upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing. Meeni, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. Peres, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. Verse 30, in that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain, and Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 82 years old. Now, wait a minute. You don't just walk in and take over a kingdom like this, do you? Not a kingdom like that. You don't just walk in one night, a prophet speaks and says, that's it. Your kingdom is found, numbered, and wanted, and now it is all over. What is going on here, really? Because it sounds really mysterious here. We read this, and if you don't know the historical background behind it, I mean, you just read it at face value. But when you read how impregnable this kingdom was, and then it fell overnight, it really sounds fishy. Well, it's interesting that there were three different ancient historians, Xenophon, Herodotus, and Berosus, that wrote something interesting about the fall of Babylon. Here's what they said. One of them said, Cyrus diverted the Euphrates into a new channel and guided by two deserters from Babylon, marched by the dry riverbed into the city while the Babylonians were carousing at a feast of their gods. This is totally outside the Bible now that they're writing this. They're saying that Cyrus was smart, very smart king. And what they had done upriver, they had dug a deep channel and a deep lake bed, and they put a little dam in front of it, so all they had to do was break the dam, and they rerouted the river Euphrates so that a good portion of the river went off into this other basin, enough so that the river, the volume of the water was lowered so that they could come underneath the walls. And they actually marched their troops right down the riverbed, and also there were some other Babylonians that had deserted and willingly opened up the gates of the city of Babylon to them. So they marched without even being noticed. Everyone was drunk, everyone was drinking, everyone was carousing, and they marched right down this dry riverbed. And in fact, on one of Cyrus's own clay cylinders, and later on I'm going to read that to you, Cyrus tells us that the priests of Babylon opened the gates of the impregnable city to him. They let him come in, just like that. And I'll read that to you. They found that clay cylinder written by him and by his scholars. And so Babylon fell overnight, just like that, according to ancient history, which accords perfectly with the Bible. And it fell just like that. And the troops marched in, and they were able to get into the city, and everyone was drunk. And God said, that's it. Your time is over. 70 years is done. I want my people back in the promised land again. You've had it as a kingdom. And that was it for them. And they fell as a kingdom. Now, the city itself did not fall, obviously. The city itself remained. And the city wasn't destroyed. And in fact, at that point in time, it's like one moment, you know, you were a Babylonian, you were on top of everything, you were the most powerful kingdom in the world. The next morning you got up and read the headlines on your clay tablets or whatever, and you're now a Persian kingdom. And that's what happened to them. They fell overnight. They fell overnight. Now, meanwhile, see, Belshazzar's father, Nabonidus, was out in the field fighting the Persians. So it's not like there wasn't any fighting going on. But Nabonidus had left instructions to Belshazzar to hold the city and to not let anything happen. He failed in those instructions. And you know, because of carnal security and so forth, the city of Babylon really collapsed. Well, I found that kind of interesting. And, you know, I kind of feel like it doesn't really matter how powerful a world empire is. But when God is done with that empire, he's done with it. And I feel like, for example, say Russia. I feel like the best defense policy would be Holy Ghost revival nationwide against Russia. If, as a nation, America would turn, I mean this in all sincerity, and if they would put back on the books, you know, the different laws against the sins that they're now advocating, the politicians and so forth, if they would regroup and turn to God as a nation, I don't care how many missiles the Russians built, and I don't care what they did, that God would somehow work in our behalf. And they would push their buttons for the missiles, and they'd zoom out of the silos and go straight up and then turn and come straight back down again or something. No, God could do anything he wanted.
Right.
They could push the button and nothing would happen. It doesn't matter. But you see, when man will not turn to God, then we find that a nation collapses. And so that's really interesting. Well, we'll talk about this later on next week. But by the time the first century A.D. rolled around, by the time of Jesus Christ, the greater part of Babylon lay in ruins. There was nothing left of it. So that today, if you were to go to this area and see it, it's nothing but desert. And there are just piles of ruins everywhere, and the archaeologists can go there. But you know, even the river Euphrates has changed its course, so that the river doesn't even flow there any longer. In fact, I read an account of a person that actually visited this area, and they do have a little motel there. And they had a guest book written there, and of course you'd write your name and address and everything. And this guest wrote, "No wonder Abraham left this place. You know, anyone would leave this place. It's desolate. It's arid." Of course, it wasn't like that back then when Abraham left. There's nothing there. I'll give you some prophecies of this very thing next week. And then we're going to be on an entirely different topic. We're going to look at a real interesting Bible custom next week.
Fine, my brother, how are you?
How's David?
Well, the only thing that I've read is that upstream, and you know, it sounds to me, it sounds kind of, it's not a pretty wide river.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a large river. Now, I don't think they diverted it. I don't think they diverted the whole thing. I think, now like, the historian said that they marched into the dry riverbed. But, you know, if you diverted a river like that, in a short period of time, it was still a reservoir. You know. But I think what I've read and what was explained to me is that there was a lowland, like a swamp area, upstream, and they dug a channel over to that lowland area, which siphoned off enough water that enabled them to walk in on the riverbed, even though there was water there, and come in that way and get underneath the water. Mm-hmm. Well, they actually came in on the riverbed, and then once they got into that main riverbed, there were actually even some of the Babylonian priests that opened up the gate and welcomed them. And in fact, they welcomed him as a god.
They welcomed him as a god. They diverted it off
the side. If that's true.
Yeah, right. No.
But I'm sure it didn't stay, you know, it's not like the river constantly then flows into that diversion or reservoir formed or whatever. And you know, you would think that the Babylonians had to know that something was up. But I think that, see, they were so self-secure that there's a certain self-reliance that a person had like that and so forth. And some of these ancient conquering empires were extremely industrious, like the Romans and everything. You read about the Romans conquering Masada and everything. They actually built for hundreds of feet up in the air, towers made out of solid stone and rock and everything to get over the walls. And it's been years going on. Years to me. Just incredible, yeah. And I mean, like the Persians now, the Persians literally, at one point in time, they had the largest army of the world. They had a couple million in their army. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was incredible. And of course, they conquered, they covered the whole world all the way from India all the way up over, and they actually started battling again. And they would fill 500,000 or 600,000 people at a time. In a single battle, 500,000 or 600,000 people with battle elephants and everything. Yeah. Yeah. It's really, when you start looking at Persia, it's really fascinating.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Yeah. Well, Cyrus,
Uriah has to look at the area.
And so,